Good morning, everybody. Good to be back together again. You can open up your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 17. We will finish up with David this week, I think. I want to go back into one of the most famous stories in the Bible and continue to ask this question of what resources does David have to be listening to God and responding to God in this early moment of his life? That's kind of where we left our conversation last week, thinking about that. And then near the end of class, we will then jump into one of the darkest chapters of his life, which for the Hebrew Scriptures, it's amazing to me, even now, as important as the Davidic line is in the Hebrew story, that this story is there right in the middle. It's just a powerful testimony to the nature of the Hebrew God and the way he wants his story to be told and the way he's involved in lives. It certainly could have been something left out. But it wasn't. And so we'll have time to jump into those waters as well. So, 1 Samuel chapter 17, we'll pick up with the second section where, if you remember from last week, David has now been called into the king's court to answer for his naivete, maybe, that he wants to go ahead and take care of this issue. Why is this army just sitting on the sidelines? And why is this uncircumcised Philistine allowed to rant and rave? Who's stepping up? Why are we in a pause moment? Okay, and then let's go into the text. And I'm just going to invite you to, again, listen to kind of what the story is offering us and think carefully about how in the world does David become so confident in this? Good or bad? We don't have to just assume this is just a great positive narrative, but we want to listen to David. Evidently has some kind of connection with God that allows this moment to take place. So we'll listen for that. I want to start with verse 32 and go all the way to 40. So here's the pickup when he gets into Saul's court. David said to Saul, "Let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine. Your servant will go and fight him." Saul replied, "You're not able to go out against this Philistine and fight him. You're only a boy, and he has been a fighting man from his youth." But David said to Saul, "Your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock, I went after it, struck it, and rescued the sheep from its mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by its hair, struck it, and killed it. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, because he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." Verse 37, Saul said to David, "Go, and the Lord be with you." Then Saul dressed David in his own tunic. He put a coat of armor on him and a bronze helmet on his head. David fastened on his sword over the tunic and tried walking around because he was not used to them. "I cannot go in these," he said to Saul, "because I am not used to them." So he took them off. Then he took his staff in his hand, chose 5 smooth stones from the stream, put them in the pouch of his shepherd's bag, and with a sling in his hand, approached the Philistine. All right, so let me just invite you to let go of your childhood memories of this for a second. Okay? Because it's about the coolest story in the Bible. I mean, we really are dealing with one of the coolest stories, right? But I really want you to think about David in this moment interacting with the king. And where is he getting this imagination? What are you seeing in the text that says, hey, this is not a problem? And likewise, what is Saul seeing in this moment? Let's write a few of the things that you're kind of hearing there.
Mm-hmm. I do have kind of a question, because you said let go of your childhood memories.
Yes.
And that's fine. But you said something earlier about walking into the court of the king. And I get that to be more than just a physical environment.
Yes.
But I'm struggling with how this comes, how this whole scene comes about. In other words, did the Israelites just go and you know, send a contingent, which includes the king, and they just sit there while the Philistines come and do the same thing, and they talk for a little while, and then they go back and sleep, and then come back next day, you know, here, let's go back and let's, we're going to rip into you today some more. operation.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I'm not...
You don't understand the battle context of how they kind of interplay around
this?
Yeah, okay, sure. Well, I'll give you just a little sense of what the text is kind of revealing to us, in the sense that this field of battle is chosen, and then you have the two representatives who are going to symbolically decide this. So they agree, we will send ours, you send yours, and that'll settle what this dispute is about. Here's the thing that's failing for the Israelites. Saul won't step up. Nor has Saul created somebody or authorized somebody to become the person that gets set up. So it doesn't have to be the king necessarily, because Goliath's not the king, right? He may be the war leader, but he may not be the king or responsible for the tribe. But you have this dynamic of stalemate and fear, and the Philistines, in a sense, owning them. To say, hey, we've agreed that we'll settle this in this way. Where's your man? Is he going to show? So that's where David then encounters this stalemate and says, why are we not settling this? And David then having this other kind of way of looking at it, that evidently, on the battle, nobody seems to hold this view. In other words, they don't look at Goliath and say, because he's not one of us, God will take care of this. Nobody seems to be thinking that. They are thinking more in the lines of, and this is what the narrative has offered us, we want to be a nation like other nations. We want to have a king just like other kings, so we want to do battle like they do battle. Does that make sense? So that helps you to kind of frame, as David comes to Saul, where's Saul kind of at? Why does Saul not have a man to do this? Those kind of questions are sitting right there in the text.
This was an Eastern European kind of thing, where you came to battle and you said, you choose yours, I'll choose mine, and we save all these other lives.
That's right. Yeah, this is efficiency too, isn't it?
This is a deal that seems strange to us.
Yeah.
But that was an Eastern European thing that went on.
Yeah, that's right.
You had your army there.
It's an organization of how they dealt with battle.
Right.
And we have other, you could look in history and kind of see how do people think about battle. So this is an ancient view into that, how they're negotiating it. It's not a roaming band of barbarians. They're a little more organized than that. They have ways of dealing with conflict. All right, so let's go back into kind of what the text is with David. That helps you hopefully a little bit understand some of the tensions there. But look at David, look at Saul. What's available in this text about why David goes the way he goes?
David's filled with the Spirit, for one thing.
Yes.
Saul isn't.
Yeah, the Spirit, which is kind of the backdrop of the narrative. Somebody is anointed, somebody is not. Okay, what else?
He's clearly had experience. He experiences the lion, the bear.
Yeah.
I'm just a young man. The fact that he would survive those tells him.
Yes.
I've had an encounter, and I'm able because I've got God.
Yeah, good. So when David was out in the field with the sheep, who does he ultimately translate the power to when he saves the sheep? He doesn't say, I'm just a really awesome shepherd. I'm so good. But he says, the only reason I was able to do this is because of God's power. And for David, can he see a difference between a lion and Goliath? Do you think he sees a difference?
No.
He says it right out, doesn't he? He says, I'm not sure where you're seeing it or feeling some anxiety about this. If I can, by my hand, grab a lion by the fur and jab it and kill it, why would this be any different?
I think he exudes confidence.
Yeah.
He's really confident.
There's confidence in there. Is it a teenager problem, though? In other words, teenagers feel immortal, and they tend to... I'm just reading the text a little differently here. But they tend to think, I cannot die. And God forbid, maybe a teenager has faith. And so that faith might say, God won't let me die.
That's why we have young guys get drafted, used to be.
True enough. Doesn't the military sort of get this? Like, they don't draft guys like me, right?
No.
I mean, guns shoot far, so do they really need a young one to do it? I can shoot just as much as they can, but there's something else there, right?
Well, they can see past 40.
I would think just my personal power like they would flee.
Well, to that point, David's unencumbered by the idea of my whole kingdom rests on this outcome.
Yeah, good.
No fear.
So it's confidence, but he's also not connected.
Right.
Is that a fair way to put it? In other words, it's Hebrew.
Saul is thinking, I have this whole tribe, I have this whole thing, and they have somebody over there, I have to find the one person.
Yes.
That will do that because that'll determine all these things down the line.
Yeah.
And David just says, that bully up there, I can take him.
Yeah. Yeah, he doesn't feel, that's important. Yeah, he doesn't feel the mantle of the king. And I think the armor is the way you get into that. In other words, David, for you to take on this role, these are the things you're going to need. And David says, I don't understand this world. I don't understand
it. He trips him up later.
Yeah.
He does become the king. Then he's saying, wait a minute, I got all this stuff to
Yeah, then what he actually takes on, yeah, exactly right, the form of recognition.
Yeah, David also realized he had a unique skill that nobody else
considered. What would you call that skill? What would you say it is?
Being able to use a sling.
Yeah.
Yes. He was taking a gun into a knife fight.
Yeah, there you
that's
go. That's interesting, too. Does David have superior technology here?
Yes. Tribe of Benjamin was noted for their slings.
Okay, so maybe there's some kind of historical backdrop to that, that they're noted for that technology. That could be.
But the text talks about how Goliath had all this armor.
Yeah.
And so they were expecting a hand-to-hand fight.
Yeah, that's right.
And David's like,
Why
would I do that?
Yeah.
I've done it to the lions and the bears.
Yeah.
I can do it to Goliath.
Yeah, so in David's world, this is what Saul doesn't get. Dead is dead.
Right.
Right? I mean, there's that kind of logic, like Saul comes up with all of his armaments, and this is the way we play, David. You can't play your little dog. Don't throw me that kind of thing. No. Dead is dead. And so if I kill you, game over, and he feels this agency with God to say, what is there to really be afraid of right now? Dead is dead. I don't have to play by those rules. He tells Saul that, and then he tells Goliath that. Basically, I don't play by this.
Don't you think it's ironical that Saul used a little kid? I mean,
what does it reveal about Saul? Let me ask that question.
A coward, huh?
Well, in truth, I mean, you're supposed, if you follow the full narrative, it reveals something about the character of Saul. In other words, if Saul doesn't believe in David, then Saul should go. Right?
This also reveals a little bit about the character of David.
Yeah.
You know, David refers to when he was a shepherd. And as interesting it is to know that he killed a lion and he killed a... That's interesting to know, but he took care of his sheep. He has a shepherd mentality.
Yeah.
And he kind of even says, I don't want my people to lose courage because of this Philistine.
Yeah.
His whole motivation is because of this shepherding or servant leadership that he fought in.
Yeah, and later in the text, I can't remember if it's in the passage we'll read, but it said, actually, I think it will be in the next text, where God says, I pulled you out of the field. So God, if we're talking about when God speaks or how God speaks, realize that where you come from actually matters. It really, really, really matters. And I'm afraid in our times and in our cultures, wherever they might be, sometimes a culture says this is when you start to matter, whatever that might be. But God says, I'm watching right here. I pluck people. And the reason I pluck them is because I see what that thing is going on right there. It's not meaningless. And the more you partner with God, the more meaning you start to discover in it. Right? So this is why I did a story class. I mean, you learn your story. And you say, God was so active there, and I've never been able to get my hands on it close enough to see what was going on. God doesn't have to change you into something that he wants to use. He takes you where you are, and he partners with you. So we'll walk together. So thus, David's logic here in this situation is, let's see, God, we've walked together before. Okay, I need 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's all the logic that he has available. He doesn't have sword logic, so to speak. Doesn't have armor logic. He has shepherd logic. And God says, that's all we need for this.
God works that way today.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, if I'm a soldier, if I'm an Israelite soldier up on the hill, I've seen this 9'9" guy come out carrying a 20-pound spear in, wearing about 200 pounds of armor each day. Mm-hmm. And so there's 40 days there he's done this. And if I'm a man of God, I've been over there praying. Well, God's not doing anything.
Yeah.
You know, but the 41st day, God's going to do something.
Yeah.
And so I can't help but think, in those 40 days that's going on before David comes into this story, God's sitting there planning, working through David.
Yeah.
And when it's time, he sends something that if I'm the soldier, I don't recognize that.
I can't see God moving
on
that day 41. That's
David.
Right. Yeah, that's right. And the brothers echo this, don't
yeah.
they?
Yeah.
What, you're, you know, this is not where you, thanks for the cheese and bread, but we don't really need you here. Right?
So we're hard on them, but if I'm a soldier,
yeah.
I'm thinking just like they are.
That's right. Why would you be aware of that? And that's, of course, going to raise up David and say that's why David's different. He's been walking with God, and now he's brought to this place. And again, don't romanticize it too much, and I'm going to try to spoil that here in just a minute with David. But don't romanticize this moment too much. But just look at what God uses, what's available. And how oftentimes we are so busy affirming things that God's not really working in that we cannot become perceptive when a little shepherd boy comes across and we go, ooh, 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 follow that. Because that's the guy that kills the giants.
Mm-hmm. Which teaches me something about my life today.
That's right. That's right. That's where that arrogance, confidence, those kind of virtue vices.
And I'm
really
looking for God in this thing. It's a little bitty.
Yeah, that's right. And oftentimes that's the way the narrative ends.
And he also, I mean, he wasn't just saying, he kind of looked at Saul and said, you know, he's not just taunting us, he is defying the living God.
Yeah, yeah.
He's defying God, it's not about these armies. He's defying the army of the living God.
Yes.
So he brought to the surface, this isn't about the armies, this is about him and God.
Yeah, that's right. That's how David reads the situation.
Right.
And maybe, to give Saul a pat a little bit, maybe Saul has just that moment like Samuel had or like Eli had. Maybe that is God.
Yeah.
So maybe I'll let you go. Maybe it's not totally self-centered. I mean, you can read the text a little more openly and just look for some of that. Okay.
In David's mind, he was prepared too.
Yeah.
Because he did pick up five stones.
Yeah, that's right.
I have to have some more than one.
Yeah, he didn't go in and say, I don't know what I'm going to do here yet. He said, no, this is kind of the tool, looking out the field, this thing
you
that
know,
I've seen.
I was told once by someone teaching this that the reason he might have picked up five is he had four brothers.
Yeah.
They were probably back in the line. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't like that.
That's I don't like it either. I didn't like it.
No, it's not good teaching. No, it's not good teaching. Get her. Whoever said that.
I think it was your mom, Frank.
Let's go to the last section of the text. Verses 41 through 51 is all I want to read for the rest of this chapter. But let's go ahead and see how the story plays out. And again, listening for these little tones in the text. Okay. So 41 says this, meanwhile, the Philistine with his shield bearer in front of him kept coming closer to David. He looked David over and saw that he was only a boy, ruddy and handsome, and he despised him. He said to David, am I a dog that you come at me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. So somebody's doing some divine thinking. Right. Come here, he said, and I'll give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field. David said to the Philistine, you come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will hand you over to me, and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. Today I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. All those who gathered here will know that it is not by the sword or spear that God saves, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands. As the Philistine moved closer to attack him, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet him. Reaching into his bag, David ran quickly. Did you catch that? That's interesting. Reaching into his bag and taking out a stone, he slung it and struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell face down on the ground. So David triumphed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone. Without a sword in his hand, he struck down the Philistine and killed him. David ran and stood over him. He took up the Philistine's sword and drew it from the scabbard, and after he killed him, he cut off his head with his sword. When the Philistines saw that their hero was dead, they turned and ran. All right, so we're just tailing out the story now, but is there anything else that might help us understand some of David's experience in this that helps us get this story even better? Or something that jumped out to you that was interesting? Yes?
If you go back to 1 Samuel 13:19, uh-huh. A little context too as well. There were no blacksmiths in the land of Israel.
Good.
The Philistines wouldn't allow them for fear they would make swords and spears for the Hebrews.
Good. Yeah.
So Saul had also relinquished his authority over the land, even though God had chosen as a king. He still didn't take responsibility of what the king should be doing. So in the context of war, the men are sitting right there with, what do they have to fight with?
Understandable reaction, because the Philistines represent, at least in their small experience, the superior military power. They have technology that the Israelites don't have. They don't make the weapons of iron or bronze. That's not their culture yet. So, again, this actually fits the Old Testament narrative of, you don't need that technology. You don't need it. You think you want it. You think you want, the way they say it, the chariots. But you don't need it. Not for what I'm trying to do.
This is pretty typical of Israel in their battles with mankind.
That's right.
They were always the underdog.
That's right.
They were at a distinct disadvantage. And David said it in verse, 46, 47. He says, the battle is the Lord. So yeah. I think David saw the fact that this is not something that I do on my own. I do it in the strength of the Lord.
Yeah.
And the Lord will win this battle. For the Lord.
That's right. That goes back to that early covenant, doesn't it? Who's going to protect Israel? Is Israel going to protect Israel? No. God's going to protect Israel. It's a different relationship. God's not just saying, come up with your own methods and I'll, kind of walk alongside you. He says, I'll be out in front. And David exemplifying that to say, we can take on anything. Doesn't matter. Because this is what we've covenanted with the Lord God to do. Something else about this text you want to bring out, and then we'll jump over to some good old adultery.
I don't want to debate that at all. Right? David's just kind of going back.
Yeah.
It's like when we experience God in this seemingly impossible,
yeah.
A bear in a line with my bare hands, that our courage, kind of, he understood it had nothing to do with the stones.
Yeah,
those were certainly going to be a vehicle, but it was going to demonstrate God's faithfulness and his goodness and his sovereignty in it all. He understood that. He had that kind of relationship.
That's good. And I would say this too, and this is why I want to read this next passage as well, is that just because you have a David and Goliath moment doesn't mean you won't have to keep going back to those places.
That's right.
In other words, there may be times when God equips you and you powerfully experience kind of that God's really in this. But I'll tell you what, there's other times where you got to go back to the battlefield and it doesn't go that way. And you say, well, now what do I do with that? Now, God doesn't promise kind of a linear, predictable experience, does he? Boy, if we're teaching that in the church, we ought to stop. Because that's not life. Life has all kinds of variables going on. God's ever present, ever active, but boy, there's times when he says the stones will do, and this is going to be a powerful experience for you, David. There's other times when it says, I got to send the prophet this time, because the battle didn't go well. But it doesn't mean I'm not there. And it definitely doesn't mean I'm going to stop speaking. I'm faithful. Something else about David and Goliath that you think would add flavor? Yeah.
I just appreciate that when he had conversation with Goliath, he pointed out, you can insult me all you want to.
Yeah.
But you called out my God.
Yeah.
And you're going to die today because you called out my God.
Yeah. There's something very potent about that. That David's sense of identity is in deference to the God of Israel. Now, again, he's going to struggle with this in the story, but here's a moment in his youth. And oftentimes youth can be this way, can't they? they have a spiritual connection that later on in life gets kind of windowed down a little bit. But David kind of saying, hey, take a shot. It's fine, because here's the thing. Here's God. And you've chosen to go after him. So he'll use me. He'll use whatever he wants to use, but you're out.
Right? Well, that also is reflected in Meshach, Abednego, and Shadrach. And that they did the same thing. They said to the king, you do whatever you want to us. We're covered.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. Yeah, and you'll find this story's all over the place. This way of my identity is not the top identity. And of course, the stories that really go bad in the Bible are what? When you put your identity out front and you say, God's authorizing me, versus the other way around.
Okay. I do find it funny that Goliath despised him more because he was handsome and healthy.
Yeah.
Why was that in there?
I really
don't know. He's healthy and handsome, and he despised him.
Yeah. Maybe, I don't know, it's almost like the five stone thing. I don't want to kind of touch on that. You know what's fun, and this is hard to have access to, but one of the beautiful things about the Hebrew scriptures that Christians really don't practice is that they would have interpretive traditions embedded underneath the text. So when you read the Torah or the scriptures in Hebrew, you would always have these, here's ways we've heard it over the years. And that's the kind of passage similar to the five stones. Sometimes these teachings come from there. Or a rabbi says, I'll tell you what this means. Which is kind of cool. And they have a reason for saying
so
it,
so they had commentaries back then.
They do, yeah. Kind of a running rabbinic commentary.
Cool.
Yeah, it's very
cool.
Yeah, and
I'd like to say, I think it's kind of fun, too, that the Philistines didn't keep their part of the bargain.
Yeah.
They took off running because they saw who God was.
Well, the scenario flipped, right?
Yes. Yeah.
I'm happy to play as long as I know how it's going to play.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And then when it doesn't, everything blows apart.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. 2 Samuel. We got to do adultery before we leave. It's a good pick-me-up. 2 Samuel chapter 12 is where we want to go. I want to do a little storytelling on chapter 11 because I didn't want to necessarily read it, word for word like we've been doing, because it's not kind of where I want to put the spotlight. But I do want to bring up a couple textures to this. So another famous story, right? I mean, this is a big moment, and in Scripture it's got all this complexity in it. Especially for our time. Texts about unfaithfulness, we got to read them better.
Yeah.
We got to read them better. We got to read them closer to listen for what's in there. This text is a beautiful text. Beautiful text that gets right down to where we live. And it helps us navigate things that we have a difficult time navigating. So I want to kind of just throw that out there as a general orientation on it. But remember the scenario that David and Bathsheba are undergoing. What's the very first line in chapter 11, right? In the springtime, when the kings are meant to go off to war, where is David? He has somehow kind of absconded his duty. There's this expectation, David, you are now the king, and there's a rhythm to the way the king preserves the kingdom. The springtime is when you do your duty. This is what God has asked you to do. You are the anointed one. And instead, David says, I think things are fine. In some ways, David's built a little bit of an empire that he can send out somebody that he trusts to execute the things that are militarily important, but he's no longer participating. So here's the first move. My identity, my role, my calling. When I get to a place where I don't have to be directly hands-on, one of the first temptations is to divorce myself from that responsibility. So if you think about business, small business owners are quite passionate about their business in every facet. But if the business grows, what happens to the owner, the founder? They become divorced from little steps, from what made the business real, right? And you kind of get this same sort of thing going on here, that David's starting to lose a little bit of what's really important, is to say that God called you to this purpose, and though you may have more resources now, David, I still need you to be this person. So he's not prepared for the change. And then Bathsheba, probably something I just want to mention just in passing, you know, whether this is a rape, whether this is acquiescence, I'm going to kind of let that just sit. But there's multiple ways people read this. Is Bathsheba pure victim? Is she complicit? you know, who takes a bath on the rooftop? You can go either way with that question. But in the text, realize there's complexity, not simplicity. We have had a tradition of putting it all on Bathsheba, particularly just interpretively. We kind of hit the woman hard with, if she hadn't have done that, David wouldn't have seen it. But where does the chapter start? David wasn't doing what David was supposed to be doing. So it didn't matter if it was Bathsheba or somebody else. David was in a position to suffer because he was not embracing what God had asked. Okay?
Yeah.
So I want to touch on that. There's also an interesting little passage that connects to 2 Samuel chapter 7 in verse 11 of chapter 11 before we get into the reading. This is very pointed. Uriah said to David, remember, David gets in trouble, she gets pregnant, and then it's all of a sudden this, I got to cover it up. So he invites the husband back, and he's trying to make it look like they slept together during this window, so this is not his child, that's what's going on. But look at what Uriah says. The ark and Israel and Judah are staying in tents, and my master Joab and my lord's men are camped in the open field. How could I go to my house to eat and drink and lie with my wife? In 2 Samuel chapter 7, David is passionate about building a house for God. And only a few chapters later, he's desecrating the house. And Uriah, the innocent one, is holding that up in text, saying, where does the ark live, David? So, really important kind of narrative thread there that you can appreciate the weight of this failure in light of David's big responsibilities as king. Okay. All right, so I just want to give you a couple of those. It doesn't play out well, obviously. David has him murdered. On top of trying to cover it up and failing a couple of times, David goes with strategy B, wipes him out. Okay, and that's full freight into the reading that we're going to look at. That's bearing down. And we'll see how David responds to that. Okay. So we're going to split this up into a couple different sections. I want to do verses 1 through 12. And we'll look at David. Oh, David getting confronted but not ready for it. How about that? So the Lord sent Nathan to David after what he had tried to do. When he came to him, he said, there were two men in a certain town, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had a very large number of sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb he had bought. He raised it, and it grew up with him and his children. It shared his food, drank from his cup, and even slept in his arms. It was like a daughter to him. Now a traveler came to the rich man, but the rich man refrained from taking one of his own sheep or cattle to prepare a meal for the traveler who had come to him. Instead, he took the ewe lamb that belonged to the poor man and prepared it for the one who had come to him. David burned with anger against the man and said to Nathan, as surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this deserves to die. He must pay for that lamb four times over because he did such a thing and had no pity. Then Nathan said to David, you are the man. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave your master's house to you and your master's wives into your arms. I gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if all of this had been too little, I would have given you even more. Why did you despise the word of the Lord by doing what is evil in his eyes? You struck down Uriah the Hittite with a sword and took his wife to be your own. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now, therefore, the sword will never depart from your house, because you despised me and took the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your own. This is what the Lord says. Out of your own household I am going to bring calamity upon you. Before your very eyes I will take your wives and give them to one who is close to you, and he will lie with your wives in broad daylight. You did this in secret, but I will do this thing in broad daylight before all Israel. All right. It's a tough text, man. It's got beauty in it that's painful. So let's talk about David receiving this, or just you tell me what you heard in that text, and let's see what we can kind of have come to the surface of this. Remember my little paradigm of the prophet, priest, and king, right? We're getting a real glimpse into this now, what this really looks like.
Deuteronomy 17, where it talks about God says,
these are things my king will do.
Yeah.
And he gave three things for the king of Israel to do. He said, you won't store up gold and silver for yourself. You won't add more horses to your
chariots.
Chariots.
Yeah, that's right.
And you won't add more wives.
That's right.
And so David got two out of three.
Yeah.
And so what that tells me is as time goes on and David gets pretty proud of who he is, mm-hmm. with that proudness and pride comes complacency
yep.
to actually doing what God told me to do. And so this didn't just happen.
Yeah.
This is a long period of time where he's got this big concubine
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
floating in. So he's definitely got something. His demon in him is lust.
Yeah.
That's obvious.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's been able to get in and infect him.
Mm-hmm.
And so first of all, you know, he did not follow through what kings were supposed to do.
Yeah, he abdicated. Yeah.
Yeah, and so he got further away from what God said about you as king.
So there's pretty important communication here. Pride, oftentimes I found with pride that if you can get past pride itself, there's usually something else operating. In other words, brokenness will gravitate towards pride to push people away from the brokenness. And it may be in David, this is very much what you're seeing, that the Bathsheba occasion and the pride and the way that Nathan has to interact with him may reveal some brokenness in David that pride is kind of pushing.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. He's got lazy too.
Yeah, there's laziness there. And that's also a function of brokenness too, right?
He ought to be out there fighting. Yeah.
And maybe because I'm a woman, I've always looked at David as using his power over Bathsheba.
Yeah, good.
In the prison system, if an officer has sex with one of the women, he faces federal charges.
Yeah, they've elevated
because he has authority over her.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so this is very important because the parable that Nathan uses is basically when this person comes into this other person's house who has resources beyond measure, he instead robs his host of the very thing that he treasures most. And so a king in other nations would do this, right? A king would say, it doesn't really matter what you think. I have the power. If I like what I like, I will take what I take. That's what kings of the world do. But a king of Israel shouldn't do that. So we see, at least in David, a little bit of recognition of the ethic. Because when the parable's given, how does David respond?
Angrily.
And yeah, he has kind of it, and I think it's a good anger in one sense.
Relief. There's a relief in it.
Yeah. Yeah, he can acknowledge the truth of it.
He's been hiding.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's been living a secret.
Yeah, but he's not quite there
no.
in the section that we're reading, but just kind of watch how he's maneuvering. He's saying, what you said, Nathan, is true. I will do all that I need to do. I will use all the power that I need to do to get this to be corrected. So, is David completely removed from the way God operates? He can use the kingly logic, but what has been removed? His own accountability to the logic.
That's interesting, that word. Yeah. Because evidently, nobody has held him accountable.
Yeah, seems to be that way, doesn't it?
And, but he's king.
Yeah, but if I'm in a... I guess I'd put it this way. In your occupation or somebody's occupation, I think we got two choices. To run it ourselves and not listen to anybody, or to have others come in to share ideas and hold us accountable. And so for some odd reason here, David didn't let
it slide.
Slide.
Well,
yeah.
The whole populace loved David.
Yeah, David could go out in the streets and get a party, right?
Right.
I mean, if he wants to go and do political rallies after the election, everybody's happy to do it, right? We'll celebrate what's going on. But there's a divorce, and this is really important because this is the core of Christian ethics and Hebrew ethics, which is to say, wherever you find yourself with God, that is the most authentic thing. You cannot overcorrect for that. And God will always go back to the altar and say, no, 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 I don't need the sheep and blood and rams and all that. I need you. And if you can't get back to the altar, we got a problem. I hear crowds moving. Man, we didn't get very far in adultery. That's very disappointing. But we'll keep working on this because this is, again, a nice text. We'll wrap it up next week, I guess, and maybe get into Isaiah. So thank you all. Good conversation.
Have a great week, everybody.